leading with a service mind, a servant's heart. And we're both very spiritual people, people of faith. And so we look at others in that way and see that it's never easy when you're trying to create justice for people.
Yeah.
It's just not easy.
You're tuned into Compassionate Las Vegas, the podcast where compassion inspires action. Together, we're building a world centered in understanding, empathy, and courageous action, starting right here in the heart of Southern Nevada. We're taking the principle of do unto others as you would have them do unto you to heart. Now, let's welcome a man committed to fostering compassion in every corner of our city, a beacon of compassion in Las Vegas, your host, Will Rucker.
Welcome to Compassionate Las Vegas, the podcast. I'm your host, Will Rucker, and I am absolutely thrilled that you have joined for today's program. This season has been exceptional, and this episode will be no exception. Joining me today is someone that you may not know, but after this show, you're going to want to get to know better. None other than Kara Jenkins. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Will. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here, and you're amazing. So it's an honor. Anytime you ask me to show up, I do.
Likewise. Absolutely the same. And I'm just going to share this before we kind of dive into content. I always remember how to say your name because I say Kara Cares. And I like the pronunciation, right? Because I have a cousin, Kara, and I have remember which
people. It's those four letters are just, they kind of stump people. And so thank you. I do care. My family members call me Care Bear. Or people who just can't, they just KJ. Kara Jenkins, KJ, but yes, you got it. Kara.
Good. So before I actually have a question, and I'll tell you this, so you can kind of think of it as we talk here. I'm going to ask you to talk about compassion and what that means to you and how you came to that. But before we do, I want to start with introducing our audience to the work that you do and the position that you hold, because you are actually someone that is making a real difference in our state. But because of the office that you hold, it's kind of under the radar in a lot of means. So share your position, how you got there, and what it is you actually do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Will. And I appreciate that. And the fact that I am under the radar, that means I'm doing a good job. And I have the honor of being a governor appointee to the Nevada Equal Rights Commission. And so we are a commission created in statute meant to protect and uplift and create opportunities for those in the state, irrespective of their race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, or age. So all the protected categories that we've seen over the years that federal law has created for people who have historically seen discrimination on those grounds, the state of Nevada has created a commission to make sure those individuals, regardless of your differences, your immutable characteristics, or you're inherently born with traits, that you don't see discrimination. And if you do, you have a right to sue. And the commission is the agency that processes those complaints and charges. And we do it in three main areas, Will. It's housing discrimination, employment discrimination, which is the bulk of our cases, and public accommodations discrimination. So for each, if we talk about housing discrimination, that could be something like where you see a same-sex couple applying for an application to rent an apartment, but being denied on what they feel is discrimination because of their status, their sexual orientation, their familial status. That's a case we would take and bring to settlement because it's illegal. For employment discrimination, that can look like, you know, sexual harassment on the work site, demotion, or any adverse employment action because of your race or your national origin, or not getting a promotion because of those characteristics. We look into those and we settle those because that's illegal. And the third category is public accommodation discrimination. And that might look like trying to go to a movie, but not being able to get a ticket because you have your service animal with you, or they say no dogs here. Well, that service animal is an extension of me because I have a disability under the state law and Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act. And so you denying me equal enjoyment or access in this space because of my disability, my dog, it's discrimination. So they file complaints with us. And so we do that statewide. We partner with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We are the state's version of EEOC. So anyone having a discrimination complaint just in employment can file with either us or EEOC, and we'll take the charge. It's all confidential. So this is where you talk about I'm under the radar. I know I'm doing a good job. These investigations and settlements to get people whole again, absent litigation or me issuing a writ to sue to that aggrieved party, it's all confidential. It's meant to be that way. But I've been doing this, Will, for 12 years.
Wow.
Yes, going on 12 years. And I've been an appointee for even longer than that. After graduating law school, I decided that public service was something that fed me. And that ties into the whole aspect of compassion and why you do what you do and what is really driving you and what sustains you and what work is critical for you and what makes you happy. And it's making sure that people have a voice, that they're seen, regardless of who they are, they get a fair shot. And so this job marries very nicely with my love of the law and then just the compassionate side of me that says that no matter who you are, if you're a woman, black, white, gay, straight, disabled, you should have a fair opportunity. You should get access to just like everybody else.
And you don't often hear compassion and sue in the same sentence.
No.
But I really think that the work that you do is the work of compassion. And Karen Armstrong famously said, a compassionate city is an uncomfortable city. And what I think she meant by that is, if you're really doing the work of compassion, you're getting into the uncomfortable conversations, you're addressing the wrongs and creating a sense of justice, which is not necessarily what most people would think of as fun.
It is highly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because as an experienced mediator, Will, I agree with that sentiment. It's like there's this assumption that justice doesn't come at a cost, that doesn't make people uncomfortable. No, the pursuit of justice means you have multiple opposing thoughts on something that are both being fiercely advocated for, and it's at all costs. Who is right? When really, it could be different versions of right. There is truth, though, that, you know, certain activities and actions are just flat out wrong. But when you get into this space, I would say in 2024, post-Reconstruction, of course, post-Jim Crow, and with all the amendments and the acts that we've had to advance and lift up more marginalized groups, it's more covert when we look at discrimination or what people are alleging. So it's even more tricky because there are some people who, as you know, Will, and you talk about this, they don't even know that they're microaggressing or that they have these unconscious biases about people and that it has real impacts in their lives, their professional careers, their ability to make equal pay. And so there are real consequences. And then when you challenge them, it's highly uncomfortable. It's super insulting, but you just, you know, sometimes you have to get okay with being in spaces where people might feel uncomfortable because you know the outcome is for the betterment and clarification and edification of folks. And so that has probably been a challenge as a female leader too for me. It's you want people to like you, you want to be friendly and you want to do this. But as a leader, you have to have boundaries. You have to be very resolute and clear. You have to take good direction and guidance and counsel from other people that may know better than you, but at the same time, be okay with making choices that maybe weren't the best and learning from them, but being transparent in that, leading with a service mind, a servant's heart. And we're both very spiritual people, people of faith. And so we look at others in that way and see that it's never easy when you're trying to create justice for people.
Yeah.
It's just not easy. Mm-hmm.
So I want to take one step back and talk about compassion. So how do you define that word? What does it mean to you? And how did you come to that understanding of it?
Compassion is a word that you espouse a lot, Will. And I will say that even before we were taping to all the viewers, you know, Will did tell me and prep me, everybody, that this is going to come up because it's core to his messaging. And I think in everyday just thought and hearing it, I would think it be something very superficial. Like when you see someone crossing the road, you don't run them over or you wave at your neighbor, you hold the door open for somebody. No, but compassion is much deeper than that. It literally means with passion, you do something. It's an everyday thing, like loving someone. It's not a one and done. And compassion for me, thanks to you, Will, and having me really explore what that means in my practice, it means there are good days and there are bad days, but I'm very clear about the mission. I'm very resolute in understanding who I am, what my job is, what the law says, what is right, and never giving up. You have your good days and your bad days, but, you know, compassion is something that is not emotional. Emotions have you like this. Love and compassion, if you really look at those words, they are choices that you do every day. It is a practice, like getting up, getting out of bed, being present in this world, having a real voice, being seen, being intentional. It's easy to kind of be closed off and just live your life in a way where you just kind of serve self and do what you have to do. You take care of your family. But I mean, it takes a little extra step to go above and beyond for other people that, number one, may not ever say thank you, may not even know you or care to know you, may not even agree with you. The true love of somebody, that you love someone who's not even for you, but you see the fact that what they're going through is not right and you're resolute in doing that. Now, the good news is with the law, it's very black and white, and we can lean on state and federal law to say, hey, this, based on the evidence and this investigation and reviewing it legally, you violated some key provisions that say what you're doing is wrong. But when you talk about just being a good person and showing up in spaces and leading, it's way more than that. So compassion is, I would say, a verb. It's a choice. You have to practice it every day. I would say, Will, that there are some days where I feel more compassionate than others. It means being nice to yourself when you mess up, but you keep showing up and you keep going. So that's what compassion means to me. And I have you to thank for that, because it's just like those words are, they're used in such, you know, just generic ways, but it really means so much more than just, you know, holding the door open for someone or just saying hello in the morning, or, you know, how people say, how are you doing? But it's kind of like rote. You don't really care how they're doing. It's just, how are you doing? No, it's how are you? How are you doing? What's going on in your life? Really investing in someone, making sure that they feel seen and heard. And that is the work that will always forever be the work, Bill.
And thank you for being so kind and sharing that. I'm wondering, in the work that you do, as you said, 12 years, and so it's not your first day. You are a brilliant individual who certainly could be making a lot more money in the private sector, but you continue to show up for all of Nevada and for those that can do the least for you. How do you manage that? How do you stay centered? How do you stay committed? What's the secret to this?
That is a great question. And I will say that there's no real secret. It just has to be in you. It's just who I am. And I know that sounds corny, and a lot of people say that. But it, logic would say that I would go for the dollar and not, I mean, not that I'm out here struggling, but at the same time, you know, Loyola, Harvard background and 12 years in DEI. Yeah, there are other opportunities. But one thing I will say is that, number one, it's probably who I am and how my father raised me, my mom and dad, my father, who's no longer with us. But The way you are raised says a lot about who you become. It's not indicative of who you are. So I don't want to minimize people who didn't have both parents or didn't have their parents be their mentor. I was very blessed to have that. So I would say that if you didn't have parents that were pouring into you, seek that out as an adult, because there are tons of people who are willing to be that for you. But it was always brought up in my household, like, what impact are you making? Are you just taking up space? Are you just being cute? Like, that's not where it's at. There's got to be more to your existence. You live on purpose. How you make someone else feel is way more important than sometimes how you feel. That's how I was raised. How I stay grounded is with friends. I think it's safe to say we're friends, even though we're professional colleagues. I surround myself with people who are also thought leaders, very provocative in the sense that they're always kind of pushing the needle in the same way that I try to. And I get encouragement from my friends. It's really important that you have people around you that are lifting you up, because there'll be 10 million people who won't be. that will be doubting you and questioning, you know, whether you're doing the right thing. Not when it comes to policy, though. I mean, there's standards that you have to have, and there's targets that we have to meet. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people who question your ability to lead because you're a woman, because you're not like looking like anyone else in the room. You're the only one. And so maybe your voice is not as valued, but you just have to know who you are. And that really comes from my solid upbringing of just knowing that if I'm thinking it, probably other people are too, just say it in a respectful way, in a dignified way, with emotional maturity. But don't let moments or seconds pass where you're not being present or in the moment. I think that's the beauty of the human experience and being diverse and different, is that we all have different lenses that we look at life. And so I'm really curious about people in that way. But why would I be at a meeting and not show up as who I am fully and contribute in a way that's not threatening or confrontational, but rather insightful or from my perspective? That's why I'm at the table. And if I don't do that, then I'm doing a disservice to people who look like me, who have the same lens as I do, who are counting on me to be in those rooms where they could never get in. But it's through the support of good friends such as yourself and I guess my family, my faith, that makes me do this work. It's not something you sign up for. It's got to be in you. And if you feel that you want to make a difference, you want to help marginalized groups, or you want to lift up people in justice, and you can't shake it, then you need to tap into what that is, because that's in you for a reason.
That's such an important point. And it, what I heard in all of that is really following your heart and your purpose. And DEI is under attack. Diversity, equity, inclusion. You could also say justice and belonging. And there are a ton of them that kind of get to the same point. But really what it is saying, hey, everyone deserves a seat at the table. The discrimination's not okay. And how does that concept of DEI relate to compassion in your eyes? And also, because it is under attack, what would you want people to really understand about it, since you've been doing the work so long, that may help folks that may be like, oh, DEI, we don't really need that, maybe come to a different view?
Let me start with the last question first, and then work my way back. Because we've talked about this, Will. And I do this all the time when I'm settling cases and I have parties that don't really understand or can get behind the civics behind it or the emotional aspect that it's just wrong. You hurt people's feelings when you discriminate against them. What people don't sometimes respond to are the emotional aspects of the harm, because everybody's walking wounded. So it's like, well, that's your harm. I'm harmed too. I had to work really hard, and your struggle's no different than mine. That is a real thought. Howsoever, when you are operating and doing business within this state in Nevada, or in most states, there is a penalty. There is a cost to not investing in people. People understand money. They understand optics, and they understand litigation. And so I don't try to, Will, convince or change people's minds in my professional role as to why they should not have mid-level managers sexually harassing women. It happens. I'm more into this was illegal conduct. There is a consequence if we don't settle. It's in your best interest, in my opinion, to settle it confidentially and privately. And we do some training with your organization, so it doesn't cost you. You know, people understand money, and they also understand the court of public opinion, which is why the Equal Rights Commission, if we get down a path where people are just, they dock their heels in the fact that they did not do anything wrong, we can bring it out publicly. And no company or organization wants that press. No one wants it. It's just not a good look. So there's that. There's other ways you can get people to comply. And although I would hope and wish everybody could see things from a lens of equity, that diversity, equity, inclusion really means something. And that the more, I mean, even data shows that the more diverse your workplace is, more ideas, and more productivity. There's just the data on it. But some people just don't really subscribe to it. They're in their own lens about what that means. And they have their own narrative about what that means for them, which, you know, I'm not in the business, nor is the state, of trying to change anyone's personal feelings about anything. We're all about enforcement. Now, on a personal side, talking about what that means to me in terms of it being under attack, we saw that with the Supreme Court banning affirmative action in higher educational applications. So for instances of someone wanting to put their race or note that to be considered to go into a higher educational institution, and not that being a factor to consider, unfortunate to me, because one of the things that I can say is I know I'm a product of affirmative action. I know I am. Loyola, Harvard, yeah, I know I am. I came from a good family, but no one else in my family went to those schools. Then wanting to seek diversity and find someone like me, which then turned that degree, those degrees into actively working for the people, it has great impacts.
I want to right there, because I want to just hone in on that point. So you were the first in your family to attend that stature of institution. Do you feel as though you qualified, or was it a gift?
Oh, no. I worked very hard. In fact, I had summer intensive classes that worked with me to get me ready. And I accepted those opportunities because I'd never come from a family or had experiences like that. I mean, my family is, my dad was in corporate, you know, he's engineer. Mom was a hardworking nurse. So they had skills and we were well taken care of. But in those competitive environments, no one. I had no one to look up to. So I had to work really, really hard, because a lot of my classmates and colleagues were second, third generation family where their dads were judges and very connected. And they kind of grew up in that environment and they talked about cases and they had perspectives and they were exposed. It's just about exposure. I mean, you could say the same thing for anyone in a rural setting, you know, with great potential, but not having exposure. It's the exposure that this affirmative action does for people. And then what it does, it's a beautiful way of, okay, so I am now from my lens being exposed to something that's now opened up my world that I can go take back to my community, which is what I've done. Or now I can also show other people what it's like to meet someone like me. And you now are going to have a different view about someone who you may never have seen. Because I'm looking around this class, I'm like the only one. There's like maybe my first year in law school, there was like 10 of us. And we were all part of the Black Student Union, Will, and it was really awesome. And I was a secretary. Probably because we needed someone to just volunteer for it. There was not that many of us to do it, to take notes. But we all kind of found each other. And at the same time, I met great lifelong friends through that exposure. But there was no free handouts or rides in it. I mean, in fact, I feel almost like the opposite is true. The pressure is even more on you when you're the only one, because you recognize, at least I did, that you're representing, even though you don't even sign up to do it, that people look at you and now you're the representative of everyone that looks like you. And so, you know, you're late, you're not on time, you're not doing well, you're not doing your part in the assignments, or, you know, we would all get together after class and work on, we would do outlines. We would work in study groups. And so your role in that study group was crucial. And if you did not carry your weight in those study groups, no one messed with you. You were just like, it was just too much at stake. And so I felt like, well, honestly, no, it gave me equity and access, but I had to bust my, I'm still doing that. It is the walk of a unicorn.
Mm-hmm. What are you proudest of?
That's a great question. I think I'm proudest of the fact that I'm still here. Again, we are spiritual people. I want your podcast people to know that I'm not proselytizing because I am a state appointee, but it has been my anchor and my faith in Jesus. There are things that have, you know, tried to shift me from my focus. Even so much as my dad passing away last May, it hasn't even been a year yet. But this unexplainable calm and drive and then opportunities that keep coming my way despite it all, I feel like I'm only sustained by that love, a supernatural love that keeps me going And I'm just really grateful for that. So I'm most proud of the fact that I'm still here, but I'm super grateful for the fact that I'm being sustained spiritually, because the work is not easy. I mean, if it were, then we wouldn't have the problems that we do. You know, justice in the pursuit of equity is going to be an ongoing conversation for generations to come. It's going to come in different forms and shapes. Again, we're post-Reconstruction. We are post-Jim Crow. We have issues now dealing with immigrants. We have issues with ageism, homophobia, you know, it's also Transgender Day of Awareness. I want to shout out to all my trans brothers and sisters. There are other groups now that are, it will always be a conversation about who can have access and who can't. And I think what will forever drive me is that we all should.
I love that. We all should. And that's the center of it, is it's not taking from someone else. It's ensuring no one else is without. So I really appreciate everything you've shared today and being vulnerable and sharing the incredible work that you get to do for our state and our people. Just to kind of wrap us up, I want you to finish these sentences.
Okay.
And it's got to be concise, because imagine it's on a billboard and, you know, it's one sentence long or something, right? The first one I'll start with is, the greatest things in life are?
Free.
Love that answer. Love is?
God.
I am?
Enough.
Love that. Last one is dealer's choice. We're in Vegas, right? If you had a billboard and you could put anything on it in the world, what would that be?
Be kind.
Well, I think we can leave it there. Kara Jenkins, thank you so much for joining Compassionate Las Vegas, the podcast. This has been an absolutely amazing conversation. Is there a contact or a way for folks to connect with your office if they need assistance or have heard something today that resonates?
Thank you so much. Hey, everybody, if you feel like you're facing discrimination in the workplace, in public spaces, or in housing, please feel free to reach out to the Nevada Equal Rights Commission. You can find us online. You can just Google NERC, N-E-R-C, or Nevada Equal Rights Commission. Our actual website is, www.detr.nv.gov. And you can call our office, too, in Las Vegas. It's 702-486-7161. It's a statewide office. So if you want to call our Reno office, it's 775-823-6690. But I'm telling you, our website has everything you need to file your complaint online, comfortably and privately at home, with steps to guide you along the way. And I just wish you all the best. And Will, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Absolutely. Thank you. This has been Compassionate Las Vegas, the podcast. I'm your host, Will Rucker. And as I always remind you are not just a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean in a drop. And what you do matters. So live compassionately. We'll see you next time.